The latest medical and scientific understanding of COVID-19. Just 7 months ago, news reports revealed that a potentially dangerous virus was detected in a patient in Wuhan, China. That seems so long ago now. In the months since, as COVID-19 has morphed into a devastating global pandemic, there has also been an unprecedented surge in collaborative research. Scientists and doctors around the world are working together to understand the virus, find the best treatments for it, and, of course, develop a vaccine in record time. But there are still many unanswered questions about this coronavirus: who it harms and why, how it spreads, and what to do about it. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with two experts about what the world is learning and what it means for our lives. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The latest research on COVID-19 continues to reveal new information on how the virus behaves and affects the body. Today, we will talk with two medical experts about what we're learning about the coronavirus and how to fight the pandemic. Joining me, Dr. August Valenti, hospital epidemiologist and infectious disease specialist at Maine Medical Center, and Dr. Edison Liu, President and CEO of the Jackson Laboratory. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you had COVID-19 and worrying about long-term implications? Are you wondering about what you're hearing in the news about treatments? Are you eager to get a vaccine? What is your question? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Dr. Valenti, Dr. Liu, thank you so much for joining me today. I know our audience is going to be hanging on your every word. And Dr. Valenti, let me start with you. You are one of the main infectious disease specialists in Maine, based at the busiest hospital in the state. How are things going? There have been fewer cases these days. Have things calmed down at Maine Med?
Yes, they have, actually, considerably from a few months ago. So that's been wonderful.
And what about treating non-COVID patients? I know that in the beginning, all, for example, elective surgeries are put off. What does it look like today?
So we've re-geared, obviously trying to keep patient safety and healthcare worker safety in mind. We have gradually brought our services back into line. And so now our hospital is nearly as busy as it's always been. And that's good news, because we're very concerned about people who may have put off essential medical care due to the epidemic. So we're hoping to get people back in line and getting surgeries done.
And, you know, back to your super busy state and finding you're able to hold infections at bay. You're not able that the frontline workers are safe and other patients are safe.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, we've learned so much over the course of this epidemic. We now know how to better protect healthcare workers and better protect patients with a lot of the interventions and, mitigation strategies that have come out as a result of all the research that's being done around the world on this.
Wonderful. Dr. Liu, welcome back to Maine Calling. And in the time since you were last here, I hear that the Jackson Lab is involved in developing a new COVID test that's being used on NBA players and staff. Tell us about it.
Yeah, we're working with the Yale group, Nathan Grubaugh and Ann Wiley, in the innovation that they did about using saliva and streamlining the processes so it makes it less expensive and less cumbersome. The challenge that we have working with this protocol is that it's made for the craftsman. In other words, most of it is hand-driven, and the challenge is moving it into automation, which requires a certain specifications to go forward with that. We've actually worked with saliva before, and one of the challenges has been what we call the viscosity of saliva, which makes it difficult to standardize. And we're still working through that problem.
But the promise of this, Dr. Liu, a saliva test, is that there are a lot of benefits, but one is that the result would come back a lot more quickly, correct?
Well, it's not because of the saliva. It's actually partly because of the streamlining of the process. Not to go into the details of it, it cuts off of the several hours. As it turns, that our test right now, the test that is extant by most people, takes about 6 to 12 hours actually to run. The challenge has always been the surge problem. You know, when the waves come, it overcomes the laboratory's capabilities for that period of time. But in fact, you know, the tests now have the capacity to be done within 24 hours. It's really the surge issue, and the process by Nate Grubaugh allows for distribution of the protocol in many laboratories without a whole lot of automation, if you want to call it that. And this then allows for more distributed and local solutions.
And Dr. Valenti, you're excited about what you're reading about this test, I understand.
Well, I am. You know, Ed's humble, but I have to tell you that the important thing for us is that we can save on personal protective equipment in the collection of specimens. In other words, saliva is easier and safer to collect. And I think this test promises to substantially cut turnaround time, which has already been alluded to. So we're pretty excited about this, especially that the sensitivity appears to be pretty high. And Ed and I were talking before all of this, that's one of the most important parts of the test. How sensitive is it? How specific is it? And this would be a probably very specific test. And I suspect its sensitivity approaches some of the best tests we have.
All right. Well, this is a test that's not available to the public yet. Let me ask you, Dr. Liu, early on, some of the tests were not very accurate. If someone goes to get a COVID test today, if someone, for example, is a tourist and wants to come into Maine and has a test 72 hours before entering the state, how likely is that going to be an accurate test?
Very, very likely. And I would say a false anything is extraordinarily rare. And, you know, the earlier inaccuracies were really at the beginning of the pandemic, when both the process and the primers, which are one of the components, were not quite optimized. These things are really highly optimized, and there are fail-safe systems going to control for the false positives and negatives. And I am absolutely confident of the results that come out.
Are you feeling that way also about the antibody tests?
The antibody test is getting a whole lot better. Now, at the beginning, there was just too many tests running around of high variability and quality. Furthermore, one of the key problems, which is not a problem with the viral test, that is the polymerase chain reaction or the PCR test, is we don't know what the threshold is that is protective. The antibody test simply tells you if you have antibodies that could protect you from having the COVID-19 disease. And unfortunately, we don't have that absolute threshold. You can use the information to simply say, have you been infected before or not, but not necessarily are you protected.
Dr. Valenti, why do you think Maine has done so well so far with COVID compared to other states?
Oh, there are a lot of reasons for that, but I do think that we anticipated this coming. Secondly, I think that the governor's program has been very, very effective. Maine has been very careful and cautious about reopening. And actually, I think that's really been the major component. Of course, we also have a fairly dilute population. We're not as populous as other states. So I think there are many, many factors that have gone into our success here.
Okay. Dr. Liu, I want to ask you, people who have already had COVID, what are we learning about their potential for immunity? What do we know today?
Yeah, this is, we're learning so much, and Augie and I were talking before. It's surprising both of us in many many ways. First of all, there are people and who have had the virus, were sick from it, had the virus, got better, and then got reinfected. This almost never happens in a standard viral infection that we usually see. I'm a physician myself in the past, and what we find now, and this is some of the work done by our JAKS investigators as well, is that individuals who have been infected, they do mount a antibody response, but on the average, their antibodies fall almost 100-fold within 90 days. Now, that 100-fold fall may mean nothing in the sense that even at that 100-fold lower from the peak, it still may be protective. That's the challenge we have right now. We don't know what is the protective range, but we do know that individuals have been reinfected after they've been exposed to the virus.
So that's curious, Dr. Liu. So far, many of us are saying that there's been no documented reinfection. And also, there's another component to immunity, which is the humoral immunity, or these are T-cell immunities. This is different from antibodies. So I'm very curious to hear that there has been concern raised about reinfection, particularly after 90 days. But I thought that there was some uncertainty as to whether or not these cases are reinfected or persistent. In other words, is there persistent virus that for some reason wasn't cleared and then has reemerged? So I'm just wondering about that, because I think a lot of us are saying there's not really widespread documented reinfection.
Yeah, so one of the issues here was always, you know, the incredulity of all of us that this was happening, and we always blamed the test. That when these things were documented, the usual protocol was individuals could not leave their isolation except for two test negatives consecutively on every other day. Now, I'll be honest with you, I've never seen two false positives back to back, you know, at that frequency. So I have to interpret it as reinfection. That reinfection is very, very low. That's for sure. But the simple fact that it does happen, and the fact that we actually see a drop in antibodies, raises some concerns for a spectrum of individuals, not all individuals. But it tells us that we need to be cautious, that we can't expect people who've been infected to be forever free of being infected again.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't think we know the duration of immunity. I absolutely agree with that. It is very interesting, because that's a really important point as to whether or not, and, you know, if people get reinfected, when do they get reinfected? You know, what is that time period? Right now, we're using, as you indicated, we're using a 90-day period, and after that, we're retesting and considering, you know, on a theoretical basis, that if you've gone by 90 days and you've had negative tests and now all of a sudden you appear positive, it's likely, or we're considering it, reinfection. So that's a really interesting point.
Well, I want to bring in. Go ahead, Dr. Liu.
Well, just one last thing is that there's even more of a complication. The test itself tells you if you have viral DNA, RNA, excuse me. The challenge is it doesn't tell you the true infectivity. And as you know, Augie, there's already some epidemiologic data that suggests that that individuals who, you know, by the way, this is the Korean experience, who either persist for a long period of time or come back with the virus, when they try to track the contacts, none of the contacts have been infected, as you know. Now, that's not proof that people are no longer infectious, because once you've been infected, people usually are very careful and apply PPE or personal protective equipment and have more physical distancing. But nevertheless, it tells us that infectivity, as you would in a clinical stance, may not be totally assessed by the positivity by any means whatsoever. So we still don't understand the full spectrum of the biology of this virus.
Mm. And I wanted to throw into that the discussion right now going on, and I'll start with you, Dr. Valenti, about plasma from people who have had coronavirus and recovered. What can you tell us about where research is showing us today about how effective use of that plasma might be?
So this is an old technique. It's over 100 years old. We've used blood products or plasma from people who've recovered from a number of infections to treat patients who have a current infection. Most recently, we've seen this being used in Ebola, but it's been used in a number of other viral illnesses. So to make a long story short, this is being looked at right now. There's the Mayo Clinic has been sort of leading a study that actually Maine Medical Center has been cooperating with. And we are using convalescent plasma. And the results right now appear to be good. And the promise, of course, is that the convalescent plasma presumably contains antibodies. As Dr. Liu suggests, we may not know the level of neutralizing antibodies that are in any particular specimen of convalescent plasma, but it really sort of sets us up for the use of antibodies, possibly manufactured antibodies. Now, we have the capacity to actually make antibodies. And this is promising. And so, yes, convalescent plasma works. I'm hoping that we can begin to manufacture antibodies that will be effective in the future. And we're already seeing that in research that's being done on monoclonal antibodies, for instance. There are a number of universities and also companies that have been working on antibody treatments.
And how would these be used? Would it be used differently in a different way than a vaccine, or are we really talking about the same thing with different names?
Well, a vaccine is designed to take the host's own immune system and gear it up to recognize and then fight an infection. When we're using antibody treatment, either convalescent plasma or manufactured antibodies, basically that's a kind of a passive way of introducing antibodies into the system, but it doesn't do much for your own immune system.
Mm, I see. And Dr. Liu, before we go to our first break, I have to ask you about vaccine development. Right now, I know that Moderna has infected intentionally some patients, the first of 15,000 for phase three. What does that mean? Put that into layman's terms.
Well, let's put it clear that they're not directly infecting individuals. What is the proof of concept that this vaccine actually works is not just that it mounts an antibody response, which we know it does, but that when you take it into the field with 15,000 people, that it actually protects those individuals from getting infected. That is the field test right now. So it's not necessarily infecting people, but it's asking the question, if I give you this vaccine, will you have the same rate of infection that is turning to positive COVID tests compared to a control population. And we're waiting to, really with great anticipation for the results of that.
Right,
test.
Right. I'm sorry, I used the wrong verb there, an important distinction. But at what point do you expect to have some really good information from this phase three clinical trial?
So it depends on where they actually do the trial, because in a trial like this, in a paradoxical manner, as the positivity rate goes down in the population, the slower it is for us to get the data, because the ultimate goal is to see how protective is this in the field, right? Some of the centers that are being enrolled are in Brazil, where the COVID-19 pandemic is actually raging, right now. And our hope is that we will get an answer within, hopefully, in the next few months. But it really depends on what the population positivity rates are, at the same time.
Sure, that makes sense. We do need to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions for Dr. Augie Valenti and Dr. Edison Liu. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners manage summer heat with air sealing, insulation, and window replacement services. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And the Damariscotta River Grill, open for dine-in, takeout, and offering an expanded prepared foods menu to go. DamariscottaRiverGrill.com.
In the fight against the coronavirus, we're still facing the same problem we did in March, a shortage of masks and other personal protective equipment. This time, it's not just hospitals, but churches, schools.
Everyone that's trying to reopen needs PPE, and we're all competing for the same small supply.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that starts later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio.
As the Democratic National Convention continues, party officials are making the case for their nominee, Joe Biden.
And with Joe as president, these classrooms will ring out with laughter and possibility once again.
Live coverage of day 3 of the DNC tonight with recaps and analysis tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
And that starts this evening at 9 on Maine Public Radio and at 8 o'clock on Maine Public Television.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We're discussing the latest medical news about COVID-19. Joining me, Dr. Augie Valenti with Maine Medical Center, whose specialty is infectious disease. Also with us today, Dr. Edison Liu, president and CEO of the Jackson Lab. I'm going to start here with an email from Susan. I have heard from two different sources that we should not be worrying about dying from COVID-19. We should not just be worrying about dying. We should also be worrying about the long-term health effects survivors had. I've heard from two different sources that anywhere between 50 to 70% of people who contract this coronavirus have heart damage that lasts past recovery. Can you please address this? Dr. Valenti, is this true?
Yes, it is, actually. It's very interesting. Even patients who don't have symptoms have had some indications of some long-term organ damage. There are also definite effects on the muscle of the heart, the myocardium. And we are seeing late complications of the virus. In addition, and this may not be fair to lump this, but in children, where there's also a multi-system inflammatory process that occurs later, after infection generally, about a month or so after infection. So there do appear to be some long-term sequela. And then finally, there's a group of patients that appear to have a sort of persistent symptoms. There's some concern about this that's been raised certainly in the popular press. We don't know a lot about it, but we do know that many patients don't recover in the usual 2 to 3 weeks. It's common for people to start to feel better after about 2 to 3 weeks. But I know personally of patients who have had persistent symptoms, dyspnea, sometimes recurrent fevers, joint pains, what have you, well beyond several months. So, you know, we're just beginning to learn about this, but there are long-term sequelae.
The people who have this, a lot of reports have called them the long haulers, Dr. Valenti, the people who have had symptoms for a long time, is there anything else they have in common? Are these people with pre-existing conditions or a certain age group or something like that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. As I said, we really don't know a lot about it, but yes, you'd be more likely, if you're older or immunocompromised, to have more persistent symptoms. And by immunocompromised, I mean people that have weakened immune systems. And as we grow older, of course, and I can speak from experience, our immune systems don't function as well. So that's probably a contributing factor.
All right. Lisbeth on Facebook writes, does the Yale Jackson Lab saliva test differ from the rapid home saliva test that Dr. Mina from Harvard has been discussing, or is it similar? And how is it different or similar? Dr. Liu?
There is a multitude of tests that are being discussed at this point. most of them are separated into two formats. One is what we call an antigen-based, and the other one is nucleic acid-based. One that actually asks, do you have a virus? And the other is, do you have the RNA of the virus? It might sound like a subtle distinction, but methodologically, technically, they make a huge difference. The bottom line is as follows. There are two challenges to this. One is, how do you extract the viral material from a viscous fluid like the saliva, and do you actually get enough compared to testing the nose, where we know it tends to aggregate considerably? And then the second is, how do you then do testing? The nucleic acid approach is very standard. There's only small differences between one test after the other. The antigen-based test has some unique bells and whistles that still need to be optimized.
We're going to go to Jean, who's calling from Biddeford. Hi, Jean. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you so much. I'm so appreciative of living in Maine, where we have leaders and public health officials who are taking this so seriously. I'm an educator who also lives with one who is very immunocompromised because he's undergoing chemotherapy. I'm looking forward to getting back in the college classroom next week. My question is, am I safe if I take all the precautions, which I do? I wear a mask. I insist others wear a mask. I socially distance. I wash my hands all the time. For all the people that have been getting COVID in Maine, we don't learn from Dr. Shaw and others whether they were following those protocols. And I understand the reason for that is privacy. But it leaves us not knowing whether we can, in fact, protect ourselves by following the rules. So
wow, Jean.
I appreciate you giving me your advice.
Terrific question. Dr. Valenti.
Yep. Yeah, so if I can do this by inference, let's have the population that's probably best studied is the healthcare population. We know that healthcare workers are doing far better in terms of not catching COVID because of the mitigation strategies that we have put forward, which is universal masking. And now we're beginning to add, in certain settings, face protection, social distancing, strict, I say scrupulous hand hygiene, cleaning of workstations, and just being careful about not getting into large crowds. We know that healthcare workers are now getting infected at a much lower rate. And some of the studies are actually rather dramatic about the reduction susceptibility of healthcare workers to infection just by doing the things that are being recommended by public health officials. So there are now studies that really support masking, universal masking, and some of the things that I mentioned.
So to Jean's point, and Jean's an individual who's going to go back into a college classroom, if she's wearing a mask, if she's staying more than 6 feet away from her students and washing her hands, can she feel safe going home to her loved one who is immunocompromised?
Well, again, nothing is 100%, but I must say that if her students are careful, if she's careful about her workplace and social distancing, the evidence is rather significant that you reduce the risk of acquiring infection. Now, I don't know what Jean is doing at home, and I don't know how immunocompromised her youngster is, but even at home, I know this sounds silly, but in certain situations, we do recommend masking and some kind of social distancing. It's very difficult. Believe me, I have little grandchildren, and I can tell you it is very difficult. But there are strategies that do protect people who are immunocompromised.
All right, Jean, thank you so much for your call, and good luck to you and your family this season, this semester. Melanie on Facebook asks, she writes, the Washington Post had an article saying there's evidence of, in some locations, 45% of those testing positive is asymptomatic. I would like to hear your guest's opinion on the research of this. Dr. Liu, is that right? 45% of those turning out with positive tests are showing no symptoms?
I can answer that. Yes, that's true. It's about 40% is the number I most recently saw. So there are asymptomatic folks out there.
All right, yes, and I've just learned that Dr. Liu has been cut off, so we're going to hope that he's able to call back in very quickly. We're going to go to Ethan and Insaco. Hi, Ethan, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. Yeah, I just first want to say I am a HIV or a Red Cross trained HIV infectious disease educator, and the grandfather won the Nobel Prize in biochemistry in 1947. And I, with my statement, I mean no ill will for those who've been affected by this virus, and my heart goes out to those who have. But we're getting a lot of misinformation, I believe, as far as in the mainstream media. And you know, with regard to Sweden and Denmark now saying that this has, you know, the lockdowns didn't work, and Fauci, you said the masks didn't work. Those countries are saying masks don't work, that it's not necessary. Are in Maine, people per day die of natural causes. We've had 120 or 130 or whatever it is so far. And, you know, we're really, you know, it's just hard to even get a word in edgewise. I'd like to talk to Dr. Shaw. He's never allows the public comment. But beyond that, when we're searching, like, look, take the flu virus, for example. So every year we go and we get flu shots in order to try to keep the flu away. But this is almost opposite. We already supposedly have the virus, but we're looking for a vaccine to take. So why even bother with a vaccine if we've already got the disease rampant? We just
okay.
Let go and herd immunity and let that go. And, you know, and it's also cost untold trillions of debt upon this country.
Sure. And, Ethan, you know, I'm going to let Dr. Valenti respond. Go ahead, Dr. Valenti.
Well, actually, Ethan makes a very, very important point. There's a tremendous amount of misinformation. And unfortunately, in pandemic situations, and this one is the exemplar of what the dangers of the politicization of science. So, you know, the whole, for instance, hydroxychloroquine issue, there are distinguished people far smarter than I am debating these issues. We're learning a tremendous amount about this virus as we go along, as Dr. Liu intimated earlier. So I think that for instance, Dr. Fauci, his initial thoughts about this were based on, to some degree, science. But we've learned, for instance, that masking is useful. There was a lot of debate about this early on. Now, one point that Ethan is making, and I think it's an important point, and one of the concerns that a lot of epidemiologists have is the notion of herd immunity. And, of course, these lockdown strategies and not having people, you know, being exposed to each other diminishes perhaps the opportunity to develop herd immunity. You know, and again, Dr. Liu has already talked about whether or not antibodies are protective and for how long. But it's always desirable to have herd immunity. We'd love to see something at about, you know, the rate of 70%. So I think he's making a very, very important point. And some of that is in the thinking that went into not locking down. The strategy of lockdown was mainly not to overwhelm hospitals. If you look at what happened in New York, where they were fairly liberal about things early on, the hospitals became completely overwhelmed. And so the folks like Janet Mills and other governors who said, let's have a lockdown, spared our hospitals of getting overwhelmed. And I think that's the point. Now the question is, how long do we continue the lockdown? I'll make one other important point about this. We're beginning to see in Maine, after the reopening, we are beginning to see a rise in a number we call the R-naught, which is it's an epidemiologic term for the reproductive rate of the virus, which means that if I get infected with the virus, how many people do I infect? So if I only infect one person in an epidemic, we like to see that if the R-naught is one or less, then we can get we can control the epidemic much better than if I can infect three or four people at a time. And then of course, there's the added issue of what we call super spreaders in crowd situations. So this was the theory behind the lockdown. It was to sort of allow hospitals to manage the pandemic and get people in and not get overwhelmed. I hope I answered this question.
Yeah. Ethan, thank you so much for your call. We are going to go to a quick break, and we're going to try to get Dr. Ed Liu back on the line. We're having a little technical problem there. We're speaking with Dr. Augie Valenti of Maine Medical Center, an infectious disease expert. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You might want to send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. It appears a little problem with the phones. I'm so glad we still have you, Dr. Valenti, or post on our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bristol Seafood's Fair Trade North Atlantic Wild Scallops, harvested from the Gulf of Maine and found in the freezer at your local Hannaford. The University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom. UMA.edu. And Bernstein Schur, a law firm dedicated to clients' businesses and their best interests. BernsteinSchur.com.
On August 19, 1994, the film Andre, based on the adaptation of the book A Seal Called Andre, was released. It was based on a true story of a family in Rockport that adopted a male harbor seal pup. Andre was found off the island of Robinson's Rock in Penobscot Bay in 1961. The seal was adopted by Harry Goodridge, at the time the harbor master of Rockport. Harry raised the pup, hoping the seal would become his scuba diving companion, and expecting that the seal would eventually return to the wild. Andre, however, chose to remain.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Schur and Maine Masons, celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine! On the next Speaking in Maine, Unbreaking America.
We can't count on politicians to do things out of the good of their hearts. We have to create a system that incentivizes public interest outcomes.
Join us for a discussion on how we can fix our democracy so that our representatives actually represent us. This program is from the 2020 College of the Atlantic Champlain Institute, whose theme was November 3rd, What's at Stake? That's Wednesday afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. We are discussing the latest medical news about COVID-19. Joining me, Dr. Augie Valenti with Maine Medical Center. His specialty is infectious disease. Still working to get Dr. Edison Liu from Jackson Lab back with us onto this conversation. If you'd like to join the conversation, why don't you try a brief email pretty quickly at talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. And I apologize for the technical difficulties. We've been doing so well during all of this technology. I have an email here from Jan. I want to make a mask that not only protects others from me, but protects me from others. What is the scoop of the effectiveness of the following mask layers? A three-layer surgical mask, a three-layer cotton polypropylene cotton mask, a two-layer polypropylene mask, a two-layer cotton pleated style mask, and I won't go on. And but one thing Jan wants to know is if the reusable non-woven polypropylene grocery bags are a good choice to use for making masks. Dr. Valenti, what's your advice?
Oh my goodness, what a great question and a thorough explanation. You know, there's a lot been. She's probably referring to a lot of the work that's coming out on masks. Let me just say that there are some really smart people who are looking at this, and these are there are actually textile engineers that are studying this. So let me sort of break this down for you. There's no question that medical quality masks, that is, surgical masks, are right now the most protective. There are a lot of reasons for this. It has to do with the fibers, has to do with electrical charges, and we don't want to get into the technical stuff. A mixture of cotton and polypropylene does appear to have some protection, and we now know that you have to at least double layer some of this, so that and you can tell the better masks are ones that if you hold it up to the window, you can't see the sunlight coming through. Double layers. Now, there have been some controversial studies that have come out recently. For instance, Duke University released a study suggesting that gaiters don't work, and immediately the scientific community came in and sort of went against this. This was a very small study. They weren't really looking at actual people aerosolizing virus. So there are articles in the literature, if your texter is interested, there are articles in the literature that actually look at the various protective effects of certain fabrics and layers. Yeah, and then finally, actually, there's been a study that suggests that the kitchen paper, and by that I presume they're talking about either napkins or, you know, Bounty or whatever, the wipes that we use in the kitchen, when they're layered and combined with certain cloths may actually add some protection. So the idea of us wearing masks is primarily to protect saliva from and aerosolized droplets, aerosolized saliva from going out from us. But there is also some benefit from some materials of protecting the wearer from possible airborne particles. It's not as protective, for instance, as N95s, but I don't want to get too bogged down into this because it's very technical and there is information in the literature and it is something that can be accessed by the public.
All right. We'll go to Hannah calling from Bar Harbor, and it looks like the phones are working for her. That's great. Hi, Hannah. Go ahead.
Hi. My name's Hannah, and I was just wondering, my mom is a teacher at a high school, and she has underlying health conditions, and it sounds like a lot of schools in Maine will be reopening just because we have fewer cases in the area. But I was wondering if there was something, you know, that she herself as a teacher could do to help minimize the risks she has of being infected. But also, you know, how do students and parents help minimize risks as well?
Great question, Hannah. Go ahead, Dr.
It's a very, very important question. I want to tell you that some of the smartest people in the state are looking at this and consulting with people around the country. By the way, I'm not one of them, but I just want to let you know that there are, again, some of this depends upon the age group that we're looking at in terms of infectivity of students. Some of it depends upon the classroom, social distancing, and whether or not students and teachers can wear masks, how scrupulous they are about hand hygiene. So you're going to see coming forward some guidance from experts at the state level on how we can safely reopen schools. I actually think we can do that. And I should say that I'm coming down in favor of reopening schools. But again, we have to use strategies that will make it safe for our students. One of those strategies, for instance, is cohorting students. That is, just keeping the same group in a particular classroom so that if one person gets infected, we know the exposures. That's one. But again, the other thing is reducing classroom size, social distancing, whether or not the students can wear a mask, really encouraging good hand hygiene, watching breaks when people are eating. So these are all strategies that I think work. And, you know, we have immunocompromised healthcare workers who are not getting infected and because they're using a certain strategies that I've outlined.
All right, Hannah, thank you so much for that call. I'm sure many others were listening to that answer carefully. We're going to move to Heather in Woolwich. Hi, Heather. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've heard some differing information about getting the regular vaccine this year in coordination with the COVID. I heard one source say that I might need to have it twice in 1 year to cover the whole year.
Heather, when you say the regular vaccine, do you mean the flu vaccine?
The regular flu vaccine, yes.
Yeah, Dr. Valenti.
Well, you know, Heather, I want to thank you for bringing this up because one of the most important things that we can do this year is to get people vaccinated against the flu. I really appreciate this question. You know, healthcare epidemiologists like myself are very, very anxious because this could be a very tough year when you combine the influenza season with the potential for a surge in COVID. And, you know, there are other respiratory viruses that are going to start, you know, sometime later in the fall and throughout the winter for youngsters and even adults. A respiratory syncytial virus or RSV is one of those. So this is a really important question. To answer it, let me say, get vaccinated. And I'm not sure about whether or not you're going to need two doses. It really depends largely on the vaccine. But everybody who knows anything is encouraging people to get flu vaccinations this year.
Heather, thank you so much for your question. We'll move on to Caribou and June. Hi, June. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much. The one question that I've seen slip through the cracks and I saw just brought up by one scientist is the concern of all the people that have survived the first infection with COVID and they're left with damaged immune systems. What's going to happen when those millions of people get hit with their second and third infections?
Right. Well, we don't know. And as Dr. Liu said, it's very early in the course of this pandemic, when you think about it. You know, we've been fighting this now since January, and so we have no idea about what the immune system, what the immune response is going to be, how durable it is, how effective it is, whether or not patients are going to be facing variations on this virus, which means it could mutate. And so there are so many unknowns about this. There is damage being reported to organ systems, and some of this appears, at least at this point, to be some possibly permanent damage, in rare cases, at least as far as I can tell at this juncture. But it's so early, it's just going to be very, very difficult to say. Most experts are thinking that you're probably down the line going to be able to get this virus again, but we're not sure.
June, thank you. And this is a related email from Zach. If getting COVID and recovering doesn't create immunity after 90 days, what's the point of a vaccine?
Well, again, one of the points of the vaccine, if you get herd immunity, it's to eliminate the virus. If you look at one of the relatives of COVID, which is SARS, you may remember, I think it was in 2008 or so, we had this outbreak again in China of this relative of this particular virus called SARS. And it got contained. It wasn't as infectious as this is, but it was certainly much more lethal. once you get control of it in the community, you can sort of eliminate the virus. In the same sense, for instance, that we eliminated smallpox by immunizing as many, many people as we could, we eliminated smallpox from the face of the planet. The same strategy is being employed in trying to control other viral illnesses such as polio. The idea being is if you get enough herd immunity, no more spread, and the virus goes away. So that's the point of vaccination. It's certainly at least to try to get this pandemic under control until we can get treatments. And hopefully treatments are on the way.
Right. And Dr. Valenti, I want to ask you, in addition to wearing a mask and social distancing or physical distancing and washing your hands, is there anything we all can be doing to, for example, boost our own immunity so that if we are exposed, we won't be as badly affected as we might be otherwise?
Oh, that's a great question. And you know what? There are probably a million people out there who have answers, you know, stemming from there are even folks in the alternative medicine groups that are telling us to take this supplement, that supplement. From my point of view, the best thing that one can do is to take all of the strategies that I recommended, but getting adequate exercise, getting outdoors, trying to reduce stress, which has a very adverse effect on the immune system, eating well. These are really important things. Taking your medications, making sure you stay healthy, controlling your diabetes, avoiding obesity. Obesity is a risk factor. So those are some of the things that you can do to help. You know, smoking, get rid of all of the things that that really injure our ability to resist viruses.
Knowing what you know today, what is your prognosis on when we'll be out of the woods with this, when things will be, and I'm using air quotes here, back to normal?
Yeah, I really don't know. I think the fastest we're going to get a vaccine, the fastest we're going to know something about the vaccine is in about 6 months from the phase three trials. I think the head of the FDA recently came out and is talking about making sure that the vaccine is safe. And that may, you know, in years gone by, it's taken us sometimes 5 or 6 years to come up with a vaccine. So now we're in Operation Warp Speed here, and certainly our technology allows us to do things perhaps a little bit faster. But I don't see, certainly by early next year, at the very earliest, will we have a vaccine. I don't know whether we're going to get back to normal. I think we've learned something from this pandemic. For instance, you know, telecommuting, working from home, telemedicine, these are all new parts of our approach now to the workplace. I'm not so sure all that is going to go away. And by the way, I'm not so sure that it should. So I don't know what back to normal is going to look like unless you're talking about not having to wear a mask, not social distancing, being able to go to concerts and eating out at restaurants without to worry. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Valenti, I think that's going to be another main calling program. What's the world going to look like afterwards? Thank you so much for joining us. That was Dr. Augie Valenti. He's Maine Medical Center's hospital epidemiologist and an infectious disease expert. Also, for most of this program, we had Dr. Edison Liu with us, who is the president and CEO of Jackson Labs. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Public Radio.